then our rules of procedure, protection of the process of finding the truth, would indicate to me anyway, and it seems so logical it's hard for me to say it any other way, that that's exactly the person who should be subjected to the tests of truthfulness that come with a judicial proceeding, not the opposite. And I submit to you that the real danger in this bill is it takes the least reliable witnesses, those who don't qualify as competent under this very minimal standard, and insulates them entirely from any process to determine whether there's any truthfulness or lack of truthfulness to their statement. I would urge you to recognize, a very dangerous thing indeed to present this type of evidence, especially in the highly emotionally charged kinds of cases that are normally going to be involved here. Competence is a minimal requirement, and this statute only exacerbates an existing problem. The other point I would make is that, unlike any other state, Oregon has a constitutional provision which specifically precludes the admissibility of hearsay statements, except, and I'll quote from the Oregon Supreme Court case that established the principle, except as to those well established, as a quote from State Expert Lonergan v. Gladden, except for those statements which are well established exceptions to the hearsay rule. And basically what the court has said in the past is that a hearsay exception that was in existence at the time of the adoption of the Oregon Constitution is immune from attack under our Confrontation Clause, but that unless it was well established at that time, it violates Article 1, Section 11 of the Oregon Constitution. No other state has that provision in its Constitution. Oregon is one of very few states that specifically has interpreted its constitutional provision regarding the right to meet witnesses face-to-face, and that's the language our Constitution uses, different from the federal Constitution, to be more rigorous in its protection of the process. And so for those two principal reasons, we urge you to recommend against the passage of this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Are you saying that a hearsay exception to be valid is somewhat akin to the First Amendment protections that they had to exist at the time of the framing of the Oregon Constitution? Is that what I heard you say?
What I'm saying is that under State Ex Rel Gladden v. Lonergan, or State Ex Rel Lonergan v. Gladden, no, it's Gladden v. Lonergan, 201 Oregon 163, the court held that the rule preserving the right of cross-examination, and I'll read you the whole quote. Quote, under this provision, it is clear that a right to direct examination of one's own witnesses is guaranteed, as well as the right of cross-examination of adverse witnesses, both rights being subject to the well-established exceptions to the hearsay rule, unquote. And under that provision, it is very difficult to create new exceptions simply because, by definition, they aren't well-established.
Ms. Blackman, has the U.S. Supreme Court passed on any of these, decided any cases involved with this issue?
Not to my, not this particular type of statute, and certainly not one, to my knowledge anyway, that involved the creation of an exception to the hearsay rule based on the incompetence of the witness. Indeed, all of the Supreme Court opinions that deal in this issue focus on indicia of reliability, as has already been mentioned, and I submit to you that if you have the situation of the incompetent witness, you simply cannot overcome the indicia of unreliability because, by definition, that person either lacked the ability to perceive or the ability to report what was perceived.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Yes, Candy Bartel.
Senator Hill.
Yes.
My name is Candy Bartel, and these bills that are before you today are very much need to be passed. I am the mother of two sons who have been affected by the lack of have been affected by severely by sexual abuse. And because the laws, these laws have not been passed as yet, the perpetrator has gone free. There is a severe amount of intimidation, and they're not able to face the additional trauma of coming to court in many instances. I believe that 10 years old and under are additionally traumatized permanently by having to appear in court. My 9-year-old son's therapist has told me that she will not allow her concurrence of him testifying because it could make him psychotic from going beyond what he already has to deal with in a courtroom setting that's very intimidating to a young child. My 14-year-old has also been severely sexually abused, and it happened by their natural father. However, the statute of limitations did not apply for the perpetrator to be charged because my older son did not tell for a number for over 3 years. He was too afraid to tell. And only when the younger it became known that the younger son was also being abused, then it came out in the open. I vehemently ask you to pass this bill because the fact that, first of all, children under 10 don't have the cognizance of being attuned to what is required in the courtroom. My younger son says it hurts too much to remember and I don't know how to express it. In counseling and in therapy environment where they can have a trust relationship established, then specifics come out. But just to go into an environment of a stark, impressive big room with microphones and strange people asking questions, it's almost too much for someone older than 10 to deal with. And I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bartel. Any questions? Thank you very much for giving us your experience. Thank you. Before we proceed with other witnesses, there's been a request from one of the committee members to have Tori Streisinger and Mr. Penn and Mr. Collins to come back up and respond to some of the constitutional arguments that have been made. Senator Shoemaker, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if you have looked at the constitutional question, and if you have, whether you have any advice to us on that, about the Gladden versus Lonergan case and the effect that might have on trying to craft another exception to hearsay.
If I may, Senator John Collins from the DA's Association, I think that the fundamental case is the Ohio versus Roberts case, in which the court indicated that if a witness is not available to testify, that statement can still come in without violating the defendant's right of confrontation, provided that there are adequate indicia of reliability.
But that's a different issue, though. This is the Oregon Constitution.
But the Oregon Supreme Court in State versus Campbell has indicated that they will be following the same rule as the federal rule on this particular constitutional issue. They've indicated no intent to depart from that. There's another case that, Senator, you may want to consider, and that's Coy versus Ohio. And I don't have the site right here, but it was, I believe, in January of 1988. That dealt with a different issue. It was a case where a child was on the stand and testified.
Let me interrupt that, because I don't think we could probably make that constitutional analysis here. But maybe since it has been raised as a problem, I would not like to be passing a law which is later held unconstitutional. you suppose you could provide a memorandum to the committee, and perhaps Mr. Blackman could do the same on the other side of the issue so that we could take a look at that and form some kind of an opinion ourselves whether we have a problem or not here on that issue?
I'd be glad to do that. I might comment that last session, when this was before the same committee, committee counsel, Mr. Kramer, indicated in his opinion it was constitutional.
Well, maybe I should ask our counsel, has this been researched sufficiently, Jack, you think?
I think this is a question that, quite frankly, depending on who you ask, you're going to be getting different answers. That Mr. Kramer said that it was constitutional. There is some weight. I don't know whether this is the identical bill as last time?
Yes.
I think your suggestion that the respective sides brief the issue is a good one, Senator. I would appreciate their help.
May I respond briefly to that, Senator Dale?
I might also mention that there are copies of Coy versus Ohio in your packet, either under the name file or 516, one of the two.
Senator Cohen and Senator Shoemaker, I might say that I agree with Mr. Morris's analysis that this is an issue because there is no direct case on point. That depending on who you talk to, you're going to get a decision or an opinion that this is unconstitutional or this is constitutional. Historically, though, I think it's very important to analyze how we came to this point, because the lead case is going to be State versus Campbell, which is an Oregon Supreme Court case of about 4 years ago. In that case, the Court of Appeals constructed this hearsay exception for children by itself, and they put it in the catch-all exception to the hearsay rule. The Supreme Court said, no, we don't think you can do that because of legislative history, which specifically stated the catch-all hearsay exception will be narrowly drawn, and we will not allow that except in just very small and unique situations. Therefore, if there is to be a child hearsay exception in Oregon, it shall be the legislature that shall provide it to us. That's what that case says. Based upon that, we went forward and drafted the original hearsay bill that has been in the legislature for several sessions. And we have tried to address very specifically U.S. Supreme Court cases, Coy versus Iowa and other cases, and also the concerns that the Oregon Supreme Court addressed in State versus Campbell. We believe we have done so because not only do we talk about indicia of reliability, we require corroboration of the statement before it is admissible. And a court must make a ruling that this is a corroborated statement and, moreover, it is there is indicia of reliability for this statement before the jury ever hears it. We have tried to put as many safeguards as possible into this bill, and that was our intent, was to ensure that it was constitutional. But no one will know until the Oregon Supreme Court reviews the statute and a specific case of facts.
You didn't mention Gladden versus Lonergan, though, as a case that's part of your analysis. Is that?
Except that, Senator Shoemaker, no, I did not. And I would only state, just from what I heard from Mr. Blackman, I would state that that is dicta in that case. And what we're talking about is not something specifically on point. And that's the problem, because everything that would be cited to you is going to be dicta, because there is no specific child hearsay case in Oregon other than State versus Campbell or in the United States Supreme Court.
Well, if it's a sufficient case to warrant the ACLU arguing from it, and I do respect the ACLU and their attorneys who appear for them, I think it's worthy of a little bit of study to see whether or not it has a bearing here. Obviously, it's been analyzed from the perspective of a different line of cases, and I think they probably yield on that because they didn't raise those arguments. But this raises a new argument, and maybe it is worth a look, and let us have what your advice on it.
Corey had a comment first.
Madam Chair, just to echo what Mr. Penn has said, this is an area where we cannot give you any certainty. It is an area where the Supreme Court has issued an invitation in the State versus Campbell case, which we believe this body is entitled to accept. That is not a guarantee that the Supreme Court will then uphold the statute or its application in any particular case. However, I think it is fair to say that the court has not ruled on the issue directly or indirectly, and if this body feels that the public policy behind the proposed bill is strong enough to warrant its adoption, the balance of power says that this body can do that, and then we hear from the court. We will not hear in advance.
So if I may, Chairman Cohen, this bill...
Identify yourself.
Excuse me. Again, for the record, I'm Deborah Wilson from the Attorney General's Office, Department of Justice. This bill was also modeled after the American Bar Association model legislation and their packet. It does have...
Okay, I want to stop you right now because that's part of your testimony, and we actually heard that. We've got some questions from other members here. Senator Grinsky.
I have concerns about the constitutionality of this, but I also wonder, though, on the other side of the coin, one of the biggest problems with these types of cases is that frequently the child is the only witness. What kind of corroborative evidence do you envision which will allow you to introduce this statement without the child actually testifying?
Perhaps, Senator Grinsky, I could respond. Again, John Collins for the District Attorneys Association. On page 4 of my written testimony, I think there were some examples, and included was a confession, an eyewitness account, physical evidence, and access by the accused. The Campbell case is actually a good example because in that instance there was a confession by the defendant, and that certainly would be a corroboration of the statement of John.
Well, that doesn't happen all that often.
Well, I think the issue is you're not going to be able to reach beyond those kinds of things with this bill. And I think that's the point that people are trying to say here. It doesn't reach beyond. So there's some of those cases that you're not going to pick up with this or anything else because it's not going to be strong enough to bring it in.
It seems.
And we're not. Well, we may wish to make it even broader. I think this is probably your question is driving at those that you're never going to be able to touch at least unless you go far beyond this bill. And I'd ask you to comment yes or no on that.
I think that's quite accurate.
Senator Hill.
Let me turn to a sort of a different question. As I read this, the child must testify at the proceeding unless the child is unavailable as a witness. He's unavailable as a witness if he's not competent to testify, and Mr. Blackman gave us the definition of competency that apparently is in effect, which would make it rare that a child would not be competent to testify. Thus, if that were the only test, the child would normally have to testify. Let me keep going. The other test is that the child has an incomplete memory. And that was testified against as being too broad, because no one has a complete memory. And thus it would open it up, and virtually any child would be unavailable because his memory is, quote, incomplete. And thus the only testimony would be, the only evidence would be the statement. How do you feel about modifying that clause, the incomplete memory clause, so that it's a tighter standard and really gets at the concept that the child's memory has to be so incomplete that he or she would not be much of a witness? I don't know quite how we do that. But.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, first of all, I'd like to correct my previous testimony in response to your question. I neglected to point that language out to you, that there is a separate definition in this bill. It is somewhat broader than the bill being considered, for example, on the House side, which would include when the child is in fear of testifying. But it is narrower than, in other words, some other language being considered. We would not have an objection to narrowing it still further.
The incomplete memory.
Yes.
Part, because I don't regard the competence as much of a problem if the test is as Mr. Blackman said it was. It just means the child has to testify himself in most cases. But so okay to tighten up incomplete memory so that it poses a real.
Yeah, may I respond to that, Senator Cohen? Senator Shoemaker, there's a bill, House Bill 2367, that is coming this direction that's very much like this bill. And in that bill, the original version, they used the phrase a substantial lack of memory as opposed to a complete memory, a substantial lack of memory. And if the committee sees fit to narrow it to that definition, the DA's Association, while we might favor the broader one, we certainly would not want that issue to hang the bill up in this committee. Then the other thing I would say with regard to Mr. Blackman's testimony on competence, I think he left out an element of competence, and that's the ability to appreciate the nature of an oath. And for kids, it may be that they, well, oftentimes what I've seen is the child is asked, well, do you promise to tell the truth? They don't use the formalized statement, so it's kind of in a child's language. But in my view, the ability to perceive and relate, as Mr. Blackman indicated, is rarely the problem. What is the problem is kids being able to tell a judge what it means to tell the truth. A lot of adults have trouble with that, let alone kids. So that's where the stumbling block lies on the issue of competence.
Okay. What do you think about that? Should the child be excused from testifying then if he has difficulty knowing what the oath to tell the truth means? Does that make sense? Seems to me it doesn't make sense. The child ought to be a witness, regardless of whether or not he thinks he knows what the oath to tell the truth means.
Well, that's case law, and I believe the rules of evidence now do require that. And so I'm not sure we can change that, though. As an aside, I'll say that many states have. Many states leave the issue of competence as an issue of fact for the jury, which is not the rule in Oregon.
Okay. We've got a number of other folks to testify. So.
Madam Chair, one quick question. Dale, you mentioned in your remarks the diminished value of dicta. For the non-lawyers on the committee, could you just explain real quickly what that is and why it's considered to be of less value in terms of appellate cases?
Senator Cohen and Mr. Morris, dicta, I haven't read this case, so I can't respond to it, and certainly would be prepared to give a memorandum about this, but there will be a precise holding of a case where, for instance, in the Campbell case, where the court stated that the hearsay exception, catch-all exception, will not be allowed to introduce statements by children. May take the court 20 pages to come to that decision. So there'll be lots of other statements, general statements about the law, that are not precisely necessary to give us that single rule of law which the case stands for. And they're simply termed dicta. It may give you some guidance about where the court may be going, but it also may give you incomplete guidance or lead you down the wrong path to rely upon a dicta statement that is not a precise holding of that case. I don't know if that suffices. Okay.
It does, thanks.
Thank you very much. Bud Byers?
Thank you, Senator Cohen, and members of the Judiciary Committee. I am Bud Byers, former state representative from District 37. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few words on this proposed legislation. I also wish to thank the committee staff. They've been very helpful. I wish to share some fears I have with Senate Bill 275 and Senate Bill 516. Yes, fears. Since my concerns with both are nearly parallel, I thought to save redundancy, I might cover both together. Hearsay, as provided in Senate Bill 275, and the use of video, as provided in 516, would certainly be prosecutorial tools that all prosecution-oriented individuals would cherish. We must not lose sight of the fact that not all the prosecution-oriented people in the justice system are the police department, CSD, or the district attorney's office. A large number of the judges on the bench are former prosecutors. Some of them, a lot of more of them seeking it, who have never worked the defense side of the system. Talking about people who have never defended a case sitting on the bench and ruling. If you have reservations about the statement, just sit through a trial with a former prosecutor on the bench. Not all of them, but in most cases. And compare with the overruled for the defense and, of course, the sustained for the prosecution. My point is that the system will be depending on that or another prosecution-oriented judge to rule on the protections that are alleged to be included in this legislation. Just think about that. These prosecution-oriented people will be sitting there ruling whether or not these alleged protections are what they are. During the 1987 session, and I left that cessation now. Similar legislation was considered, and I expressed my belief that it was unconstitutional. Any suggestion that the use of video or hearsay in lieu of child's live court testimony should be rejected. You may or may not be aware of the U.S. Supreme Court case of Coy versus Iowa, which dealt with a related issue of the legality of placing a screen between an alleged victim of child abuse and the citizens accused of that crime. I was pleased, to say the least, that the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted the Sixth Amendment as I have, and ruled that placing a screen between the accuser and the accused in a child abuse case violated the defendant's federal Sixth Amendment right to be confronted with witness against him. With the Coy versus Iowa, the conviction was reversed and remanded at all great expense to the state of Iowa and to the accused. Justice Scalia, and I hope I pronounced that properly, the Supreme Court Justice might not like mispronouncing his name, traced the origins of the Sixth Amendment right to meet accusers face-to-face, and referring to Acts 25:16, and it says, "It is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man up to die before the accused has met his accuser face-to-face and has been given a chance to defend himself against the charges." Justice Scalia found support in Roman law for that right and observed that it has been argued that the right of confrontation in England came before the right to jury by trial. Justice Scalia's scholarship included reference to this in the writings of none other than William Shakespeare, who wrote, "Then call them to our presence face to face, and frowning brow to brow, ourselves will hear the accuser and the accused freely speak." Richard II, Act 1, Scene 1. In light of Coy versus Iowa, the federal constitutionality of the use of videotaping is alleged in alleged child abuse cases in Oregon seems highly questionable. Before the scheme has a chance to federal level, though, it has to jump the hurdle for the Oregon Constitution. Article 1, Section 2 of the Oregon Constitution provides in relevant part, "In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall have the right to meet the witness face to face." The terms of the federal constitutional provisions are different. The Sixth Amendment provides in relevant part, "In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be confronted with a witness against him." Thus, it can easily be seen that the terms of the Oregon Constitution make explicit reference to the right to meet witnesses face to face, while the federal provision merely contains the implicit right. In 1954, the Oregon Supreme Court had occasion to discuss the meaning of the difference in textual provisions of the two documents. And I'm not going to go on to all that, but you have it before you, and I think you might want to refer to it. That's one reason there's in a little binder so you can find them easily. But there is no question but that the main and essential purpose of confrontation as provided in the federal constitution and in similar provisions found in the state constitution is to secure for the accused the opportunity of cross-examination. However, it is recognized that there is a secondary advantage to be gained by the personal appearance of the witnesses before the court and jury, where his testimony is orally given. This advantage is stated by Professor Wigmore as follows: "The judge and jury are enabled to obtain the elusive and incommunicable evidence of a witness' deportment while testifying, and a certain subjective moral effect produced upon the witness." The secondary advantage gained by the personal appearance of a witness before the court and jury is one that applies as well to the state as the accused. Often action speaks louder than words. Persons accused of child sex abuse are presumed innocent until guilt is established beyond a reasonable doubt. That is a fundamental constitutional law. The primary aim of the law is to arrive at the truth of the matter in controversy, even and especially when the matter of controversy is as important as child sexual abuse. In child sexual abuse cases, the judge and the jury are entitled to obtain the elusive and incommunicable evidence of a witness, witness's deportment while testifying, and the certain subjective moral effect produced upon the witness in child sexual abuse cases. Just as in all other criminal cases, often actions speak louder than words. To deprive a person accused of child sexual abuse the right to obtain the demeanor evidence that in-person, in-court testimony can only provide is to remove from the truth-finding process an important tool. Shall we turn our back upon the ancient wisdom of mankind concerning one of the best methods of arriving at truth, so tried and true that they are found in the Holy Bible? Shall we turn our back on the wisdom of the pioneers who established our state's constitutional ground rules for accurate ascertainment of truth? Or shall we do to perceive popular opinion? And I mean, I stress popular opinion, the witch hunt, or whatever you want to call it. Reject these principles that make the accurate ascertainment of truth more possible? Stated another way, shall we sacrifice the conviction of an innocent or a number of innocents because of admitted discomfort occasioned by testifying? I am certain that we are close in our feelings that child abuse in any form is the worst of crimes. The next in line is to be falsely accused of child abuse, let alone being falsely accused and found guilty of abuse of a child or children. The allowing of the use of hearsay evidence provided by a child that has been interrogated, prompted, coerced by an agency personnel or investigators is not in the best interest of the justice system. One of the primary supporters of House Bill 2367, he's also here today, I might tell you, it's D.A. Penn, has stated that simply because a jury has acquitted the defendant does not mean the defendant is innocent. Now, I have him on videotape saying that. Well, you know, it's always been the presumption of innocence until proven guilty, but you see, if you're on the prosecution side of this, you feel the other way about it, obviously. I maintain that the opposite also occurs on occasion. The individuals that are found guilty are innocent.
It went to deposition first since we were dealing with two states. In that deposition, which was videotaped, lasted 3.5 hours, at which time the district attorney just asked Zachary if he knew the difference between a truth and a lie, and then pretty much from there turned it over to the defense attorney, and Zachary was in that room with a bathroom break in between, but for about 3.5 hours, asking questions that I'm sure a judge would not have allowed to be asked. But that's really not what the issue is here. That happened the year after the abuse. The following, about a year and a half later, Zachary finally went to court. The deposition was not allowed to be in court then, although it was videotaped, and the defense attorney pretty much had asked all the questions. My issue seems to be that the videotape was current, the information was accurate. If you're aware with small children, what their verbal skills, what they recall, and that in a difference in a 3-year period between age 5 to age 8 is entirely different. And I'm a supporter of the legal system, but let's get the child's most accurate story right. Whether he told it to a CSD worker or a policeman or a different agency, maybe a psychologist, whatever, or if it's on a videotape, use that. Don't put them in front of a judge and a jury 3 years later and ask them to say in terms what happened then, because it sounds contradictory. Get the information firsthand and use it from there.
You are in support of using some form of videotaping. Now.
Some form of videotape and some form of hearsay. The other thing I would like to tell you is in our trial, since the CSD worker was not there in person and the psychologist who Zachary has dealt with now for 3 years was not there in person, none of that was able to be admitted as evidence. The only evidence we had there was what Zachary said. And as far as them only being on the stand or what Zachary called the truth box only for a short time, Zachary was on for over 4 hours with a break at about maybe 1.5, 2 hours in there. So I think unless you've really sat through and seen some of those courtrooms, you really don't know. Zachary was lucky. His natural father opted to leave the courtroom while Zachary testified. We told him that it was extremely difficult for Zachary to face him, and he wanted the truth to come out as much as Zachary did, and he stepped off the stand. He did not admit to doing it, but he did leave the courtroom while Zachary testified. Since first disclosing, as far as how this legislation the two bills would have affected us is, since first disclosing, Zachary has been forced to, and I'm saying forced by the legal system, to repeatedly tell and retell the story of the alleged abuse. It has not varied in any of those retellings. He has been either before a judge, before a jury, or giving a deposition 5 different times. We just learned Friday that within 90 days he'll have to go back to court again and tell the whole story over again. Although a videotaped deposition, like I said, was taken, it couldn't be used as evidence in a criminal court in Iowa. Repeatedly, Zachary would begin to heal from this ordeal, going to his psychologist, started to do well again in school, only to turn around and have to do it again. And it's the retelling and the reopening of wounds. Before coming here, since there are some people in the state legislature and the Senate that I know, and that we know as family members, I asked Zachary if it was okay, because it's his private hell. If it gets made very public. And I asked him what he wanted me to say. And he said, I just want to be a normal kid again. Sorry. And Zachary was only 5 when this started. And since that time, he's also expanded on the amount of information that he's remembered, because he feels confident. Because, you see, children who are sexually abused think it's their fault. They think they did something. And with the extensive therapy that he's gone through, he's come to realize how adults control these situations. That they're in charge, not 5-year-old children. Zachary has come a long ways. He's forgiven his father for what he did, but he can't understand it, and he can't understand why he has to go back time and time again and say the same story. He's already told one person. He's told 2. He's told juries. And he sat up tall, and it made him feel good that he told the truth. As he discloses more information, there's a chance for a greater charge to be filed against his perpetrator, and also a greater chance for a conviction. I never planned for any of this to happen to Zachary. Sexual abuse was something that happened to those people. It doesn't happen to upper middle class America. It doesn't, right? It happens to the other ones. Forgive me if I offend anybody, but I grew up thinking it always happened to the welfare mothers or people who had multiple boyfriends, things like that. But it happened to me. It happened to Zachary. And I only wish that he didn't have to relive it each time with repeated testimony. Someday, perhaps, he'll be able to grasp everything that's happened to him and why. I really think with the passage of some of these laws that there'll be a chance that he won't have to go through it again. We told him that he would have to start within the next 90 days to go back again. And the nightmares, the night terrors, started again on Saturday. It's not comfortable for anybody to sit here and talk about their private hell. And I know I'm speaking very emotionally and not quoting laws or what's being done now in this state and what's being done in other states. But I don't think it's about adults. I think it's about small children. I have a picture here of Zachary about the time that the alleged abuse occurred. He didn't even know those words. He had to show us in the actions He doesn't know. He doesn't know what it's like. We're responsible for these little kids. And we're responsible for helping them testify in any way that they can. We're not saying that we should have witch hunts, by no means, but let's provide a forum where children can be heard. Thank you. Any questions?
Betty Freya.
Betty Freya from Salem, Oregon. In the interest of time, I just want to go on record as supporting what Robert Reed said and Bud Byers. Thank you.
Thank you much, Betty. Velma Hart. Hartvig. Say to you.
Madam Chairman, members of the panel, my name is Velma Hartwig. I'm chairman of a group called FEAR in Eddyville, Lincoln County, Oregon. I'm also a mother. I have raised 8 children, and my heart goes out to these people, and I do feel that children need to be protected. But I also feel that innocent people need to be protected. A couple of hundred years ago, the people of this nation got tired of the tyrannical government. So they picked up their guns and they picked up their pitchforks and they went after the skunks. They got their very wise people to write a document to protect the people of this new nation from being subjected to the same ills and from some future government. The framers of the Constitution felt English laws dealing with children were oppressive, unfair, and unjust. So they deliberately left them out. When they finished, they had a pretty good piece of work. They sent the Constitution to the 13 colonies for ratification. Imagine their surprise when the leaders of the colonies said, "No way. We've been subjected to searches of our homes and persons because someone suspected we had done something wrong. Thrown in jail without charges and refused a fair trial. We've had our property confiscated, our weapons taken away, a religion forced on us, and did not have the right to speak our mind. We ain't gonna sign." Our forefathers, wise men that they were, then wrote what we call the Bill of Rights to address these problems. The leaders of the individual colonies then signed gladly. Until recently, we have enjoyed the protection of the Constitution of the United States, but that isn't true anymore. 25 years ago, child abuse was a crime and was treated as such. Accusations were investigated and sufficient evidence was found. The accused was indicted, arrested, and tried in a court of law. Proper warrants were issued, proper evidence presented, and witnesses were properly questioned. Not so today. We're told our Constitution does not apply in juvenile cases. Children are grabbed from schools and other public places, taken to undisclosed locations, examined and questioned without notifying the parents. Children are taken from classrooms, interrogated, and even strip searched on suspicion. Homes are invaded and searched, personal records and possessions taken away without a warrant or without any formal charges being made. Children are kept from the extended family so they can be trained to testify in court. I've heard both district attorneys and CSD workers state, just because a person is found not guilty doesn't mean he is innocent. In other words, if you're reported for child sex abuse, you are guilty. Even if the person making the report has something to gain, has an axe to grind, or is mentally incompetent. Their excuse for all of this is, we would rather err on the side of the child. I don't recall voting to repeal the Bill of Rights. Did you? Child abuse, especially sex abuse, has grown into one of Oregon's most profitable industries. Children are routinely manipulated and coached by mental health workers, caseworkers, and prosecutors. Unfounded opinions of so-called experts are considered gospel in many courts. This industry has become a bonanza for many people who have little ability and are willing to make lots of money, gain recognition, and be looked upon as experts at the expense of innocent victims of their accusations. Why? Because they don't have either the brains or the integrity to make it on their own. Entire careers are based on prosecution of innocent people. That's why this legislation is so dangerous. It can and it will be misused. We already have a problem with CSD. Anyone who doubts that statement should talk to their colleagues on the Human Resources Committee who listened to shocking testimony last July about blatant abuses perpetrated in the name of protecting children. Since most cases are under the jurisdiction of CSD, it will be those same people who will become the witnesses. CSD has already been given almost unlimited power, generous funding, and no accountability. Now we have a bill designed to take away the right to face one's accuser. This bill is not about protecting children. This bill is about an easy win. They found in spite of intensive training, children will often tell the truth when questioned by a skilled attorney. I've watched several young children testify. Not all young children are frightened. Not all young children are traumatized. And the ones I heard about, my heart goes out to them. But that isn't the general rule. But they did mess up thousands of hours of careful training and forget the details of the story they've been taught to tell. Think about it. If you were accused of a horrible crime that you did not commit, would you want to have a third person telling his version of what he thought might have happened? A person with vested interest in the outcome of the trial? Or would you want to get at the truth? Please use your common sense and look at the motive behind the bill. And just something I would like to say other than my testimony, I think that we do need some change in the laws. But I think those changes need to be in the investigation. I think these cases need to be investigated.
I want to say, this committee is drafting some legislation on investigation issues, so we'll be hearing from that a little bit later. Other questions? Senator Brockman.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I missed it if you said it. What does FAIR stand for?
FAIR stands for Fairness, Accountability, Integrity, and Responsibility. And our group is designed not just for people who have been victimized by the system. What by that I mean people who are innocent victims of the system. We also respond when...
We have people who come from places like Klamath Falls that I want to get to today. And we have committee members that need to go off to another committee. We're going to talk about trying to reschedule some of these times, but I want to hear at least from the people who've come from a lot of distance on these bills and make sure that we get to a few of them. Nancy Patterson, where are you from? Okay. Let's then, I don't have anyone else who signed up to speak to 275. Is it okay if we go on, folks, to 276, I would call, actually be...
About 516, it seems to be running in tandem with 275.
Actually, we do have someone new who signed up on 516 from Klamath. I want to make sure we get Barb Costa, who's come from Klamath Falls, on today, who signed up first, really, on Senate Bill 5. So let's move then to 516 and have... let's have Barb come up first, who is in support, just at least to get you on the record as we hear from the people who... If we run out of time, at least we will... Take your time. You've come this far. You deserve to have...
Sorry, I'm Barbara Costa from Klamath Falls. I'm a volunteer and a board member for Wednesday's Child. We treat sexually abused children as well as adults molested as children. And I'm representing a new committee we just formed called Citizens Against Child Sexual Abuse. And I'm a little upset. I basically, the tubes, Bill 276 on the statute of limitations and the videotaping, if I may just quickly go over these two. Child victims of sexual abuse often disassociate themselves from the act as a way of self-preservation. It may take years before they can allow themselves to deal with the issue of their abuse. Currently, if it takes over 3 years, it's too late to punish the perpetrator. And the devastation and humiliation these children go through when they are at last able to deal with the molest, only to find that the offender is unprosecutable, it's just tragic. I personally know a child who was repeatedly raped by her father from the age of 9 until she was 12. She was unable to tell anyone about these attacks because of threats to her person and to other members of the family. These attacks stopped only because her parents were divorced for other reasons. She was 15 before she was able to face the fact of these repeated rapes and confide in someone. As a matter of fact, I personally took her down to the sheriff's office to report this, and we were 1 month too late. In the meantime, her father has remarried to a woman with a teenage daughter, and he happens to be working in the church with other teenage children. He's free to molest again. This man also molested the other two daughters in the family. One was older, and the young one now is 10 years old. Neither one of these girls had ever told anyone else. The 10-year-old is just now starting to have flashbacks and starting to remember. But there again, it's too late. The 3 years is over, so it won't do any good. I just feel that it's imperative that the statute of limitations be extended in order to help these victims and prosecute the perpetrators. And it's time we start caring about the victims' rights and assuring the victims indeed that they do have these rights. And the, excuse me, the same goes for the videotaping. I'm just going to, these children are so frightened when they have to go to court. I worked with two children, two little girls who were molested, and they were absolutely horrified. I had to call at 7:30 in the morning, and I had to run over it, and I sat and held the little girl. She was, didn't want to go to court. She didn't want to suffer the humiliation of telling other people in public, in a courtroom, what had happened to her. If she had been able to have this videotaped, you can have the perpetrator there or have him at least behind her or something, but it would be a little bit less threatening situation for the child. And when we work with these children, it's really horrifying, and something has to be done to start protecting their rights rather than worrying about the perpetrator's rights. And I think that's basically all I have to say. But I appreciate you letting me come on early.
Is there questions of Barbara? With respect to either 516 or 276, which is more clearly the statute of limitations.
I have one question, Madam Chairman. Are you aware of Senate Bill 275?
Yes, I had planned to have that one, and I forgot to sign up for it.
Okay, do you feel
similarly
about
that? And I'm all for
that
one, too. Yes, I definitely am.
I just wondered why you weren't speaking to that one.
That was my fault. I promised I'd sign up for it, and I'm...
Do you have written testimony? Could you get us written
yes.
testimony with respect to 275, and we'll pass it on.
I certainly can. I'll drop it off right over here.
Great. Are there any other questions? Senator Springer.
Just briefly, for the witness, it's been represented in some of the testimony here today that not only have we seen a great increase in the number of reports reflecting a greater recognition, willingness of people to come forward and address this problem, or perhaps an increase in the actual number of these incidents, but it's also been suggested that reports are exaggerated or children are often falsely making these accusations. Could you just share with us briefly, based on your experience, your response to those suggestions?
Children basically don't lie. They don't come up with these words and descriptions and tell you with the dolls, show you what happened to them, not these little tiny ones. They just don't lie. And this teenager, she's a beautiful girl, and she started acting out, and now, since she suddenly remembered, you know, they block these things from their minds because they are so horrible. And I just feel that you have to start believing these children. I don't want an innocent person accused unfairly, but believe the children, listen to them. When you work with them, you'll see that they aren't lying. We have standing room only now. We have a waiting list to come to Wednesday Child. There aren't many agencies like ours, and we're all a volunteer-based organization. We have three paid people. All the rest of us volunteer anywhere from 20 to 30 hours a week working there.
Thank you, Ms. Costa.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions. Thank you very much for coming all the way from Klamath Falls. Let us hear at least, how many people are going to lose here? One, two, three. I'd like to...
I guess not, until 3:15, then there's another hearing.
Okay, do we have... I guess I want to have... let's deal with 5:16 with respect to the videotaping, and since we've had specific testimony on that issue. And I do want to call Corey Streisinger and John, Corey, whoever you... So we can get that on the record and get your testimony in people's hands. Then we will reschedule as best we can the folks who've come to deal with the other two bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Corey Streisinger, and I'm Governor Goldschmidt's legal counsel. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 516, which would permit several types of alternatives to normal courtroom testimony for some young victims in sex abuse cases. With me is Betty Ucatil, Assistant Administrator of the Children's Services Division. I'd like to give a very brief overview of what the bill does. Betty will then give a couple of comments about the policy need for the bill, and then I would like to again briefly describe the constitutional issues. Senate Bill 516, as a previous witness has mentioned, is drawn from a model rule of evidence and is similar to legislation which has been adopted in a number of other states. It would allow a judge, in a case involving sexual abuse of a child under the age of 10, to consider first whether the child would suffer severe emotional or psychological harm if called to testify in a normal courtroom setting. If the judge finds a substantial likelihood that the child would suffer severe harm from normal courtroom testimony, the judge may permit the child's testimony to be taken outside of the courtroom, either by videotape deposition, which would then be replayed in court, or by closed-circuit television broadcast to the courtroom. I should note that the bill is limited to cases involving allegations of sexual conduct performed with or on the child by another. In other words, it applies only to child victims of sexual acts. If the child is called as a witness concerning sexual abuse of another, the bill would not apply and rules of normal courtroom testimony would govern. Several states have gone the further step to apply to witnesses of child abuse. This applies only to the child victim. When a child's testimony is taken by videotape or closed-circuit television under Senate Bill 516, the bill would ordinarily permit the defendant to be present with the child in the place where the testimony is taken. If the judge finds, however, that the physical presence of the defendant would contribute to the likelihood that the child would suffer severe emotional or psychological harm, the judge may order that the parties be placed so that the child could not see or hear the defendant while the testimony is being given. This would permit, for example, the use of one-way closed-circuit television or the use of some sort of screening device. I'd like now to turn the bill over to Betty Ucatil to describe some of the policy reasons and then come back to the constitutional issues.
Thank you. My name is Betty Ucatil. I'm Assistant Administrator for Children's Services Division. The process of disclosing child sexual abuse and the resulting investigation and court action usually has major impact on the child. This is in addition to the damage that is done by the abuse itself. Some children are able to use family and treatment support to get through this time intact. Other children are fragile, may lack close family support, or may be too young to understand that they can be protected from the abuser. In 1987, there were 469 victims of child sexual abuse that were 3 years of age and younger. We have seen a trend in the last year of child victims of sexual abuse being younger and of an increase in the more serious, intrusive forms of abuse such as rape and sodomy. Children who have been harshly threatened or physically injured in addition to the sexual abuse need all the protection that they can get in order to safely offer their testimony. Senate Bill 516 provides that protection. It is a reasonable solution to prevent some children from being further victimized by the legal process. Nationally, 37 states have statutes that address video recorded testimony, and 27 states have statutes that address testimony by closed circuit television. We would urge your support for Senate Bill 516.
The portion of Senate Bill 516 that would permit videotape or closed circuit testimony to be taken out of the presence of the defendant obviously raises concerns about a defendant's rights under the confrontation clauses of the United States and the Oregon constitutions, and you've heard some testimony earlier today about those two clauses. Confrontation clause cases are fairly rare, but as you've also heard, the United States Supreme Court addressed issues very similar to those raised by this bill just last year. The case is Coy versus Iowa, and a citation is in my written presentation. I believe you also have copies of the case. That case involved an Iowa statute which permitted child witnesses to testify either by one-way closed-circuit television or from behind a screen placed so that the child could not see the defendant. The statute did not require any judicial findings of potential harm to the child, and none were made in that case. By a 6-2 vote, in an opinion written by Justice Scalia, with Justice Kennedy not participating, the court concluded that the use of the screen in that case had violated the defendant's confrontation clause rights. In its opinion, the court noted, however, that it had, and this is a quote, in the past indicated that rights conferred by the confrontation clause are not absolute and may give way to other important interests. The state of Iowa in that case had argued that the need to protect child witnesses was such an important interest. The court pointed out, however, that there had not been those individualized findings of the need to protect these particular witnesses, and it left for another day the question of whether any exceptions of this nature could exist. Two of the six justices, Justice O'Connor and Justice White, who had joined that six-vote majority, also wrote separately to address this point further. And in a concurring opinion by Justice O'Connor, pointed out first that these statutes, and this includes Senate Bill 516, frequently do not even raise confrontation clause issues because they permit the defendant to be in the same room in many cases with the child witness while the testimony is being given. Even in those cases where the witness and the defendant are separated, however, Justices O'Connor and White concluded that if the court makes a case-specific finding of necessity, the confrontation clause may give way to the compelling state interest of protecting child witnesses. Justices Blackmun and Rehnquist dissented in the Coy case, and these two justices would have held that the Iowa statute satisfied the confrontation clause even without case-specific findings of harm, so long as the defendant was given full rights to cross-examine, which they regarded as the key to the confrontation clause. Where does this leave us with Senate Bill 516? Well, as Justice O'Connor's concurrence points out, the bulk of Senate Bill 516